You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hundreds of thousands of immigrant women and girls work in fields and food processing plants across the United States. The American economy depends on them, while largely ignoring the fact that they face abusive conditions, sexual harassment, and rape. Lowell Bergman and PBS's Frontline investigate the crimes against migrant women workers in a new documentary called Rape in the Fields, The Hidden Reality of Rape on the Job in America. It's a collaboration with Univision News, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley. It airs tonight at 10 on PBS and on June 29th at 7 p.m. on Univision. I'm very pleased that it brings Lowell Bergman back to our show. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Do we have reliable numbers on how many women are working in the fields or in processing plants?
We don't. I mean, we have an estimate by the Department of Labor that there are over 600,000 women working in the agricultural sector. How many of those women, for instance, are of Hispanic extraction? They believe over 70 or 80%. Some people say 90%. How many are undocumented? A majority is the best they can do.
And are they the reason that the prices remain fairly low in this country?
Well, labor costs, as someone pointed out to me, representing one of the major apple growers in the state of Washington, makes up 60% of their costs. Other estimates are closer to 40. So you can see that the wages in the field, which, by the way, put many people below the poverty level, are extremely important in terms of the price of products in America.
Is the story you're telling here exclusively of undocumented workers, or do authorized workers also face some threats?
No, it's documented and undocumented. It's a little bit easier to understand why people don't come forward if they're undocumented, and as we said, a majority of them are. But one of the major cases we chronicle, the Tamayo case in California, she did have papers. It's really a reluctance to come forward, not only against the power of the foreman or the supervisor and trying to keep your job, but also the shame in the community and willingness to have the family know. There are all kinds of reasons and factors. And in addition to that, not a lot of faith that anything will happen if you come forward.
Despite that, you found women who were willing to go on the record as whistleblowers about the conditions that they faced. Have they left themselves open to deportation?
Well, it did take us a year to get people to go from a few to go who were in shadow to starting to get a number of them willing to come forward. In the cases where people were willing to come forward and be on camera that we use, they were able to take advantage of what's called a U visa. That is a special visa that's issued to victims of crime, particularly violent crime like rape or kidnapping. It's a little bit easier for them. But even then, people were reluctant, and it took many months before they got comfortable with the idea.
Although we're seeing some changes over the past 15 years, workers have filed 1,106 sexual harassment complaints with the EEOC against agricultural-related industries. I guess that's just a small fraction of the actual number of crimes committed against women. And the allegations range from verbal harassment to rape, but only a fraction will make it to federal court. Why is that?
Well, it's a little bit hard to understand simply because it's so arcane. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is the only federal agency that has taken an interest or made a priority out of the sexual assault of female farm workers. Their process is totally civil. That is, they can't bring criminal charges. They can only sue the employer. And the process from making a charge with them and possibly getting something done has to go through some rigorous steps, including long private negotiations with the employer. If they come to an impasse, then they can file a civil suit. So you don't see nationwide in all industries, you don't see more than 140 or so of these lawsuits in a year. This agency, by the way, costs less than a old-fashioned fighter plane for the U.S. military. So their budget is not very large. The staff is not very large. But they do have some people who got committed to the notion of doing something, particularly in agriculture, about 15 years ago, And that's given us a paper trail that we can refer to and some ability to document the allegations of the people involved.
Will the ruling yesterday by the Supreme Court on discrimination in the workplace have an impact on this?
It's going to have a huge impact, according to Mr. Lopez, who's the general counsel of the EEOC. And in fact, in all the cases we've looked at, the key issue, one of the two key issues is, was the person who was identified as the perpetrator an agent of, or they say legally, a proxy for the company? And that's a key issue in terms of holding the company responsible in terms of the women getting any damages, but in basically also in getting companies to change their policies. Because, by the way, there's only three states in the country where sexual harassment training is mandated by law and for employers of their supervisors and managers. That's often the outcome of many of these suits. So if you can't prove that the supervisor or foreman meets now the criterion put up there by the Supreme Court, negating, by the way, years of practice where the existing definition was accepted by most of the appellate courts in the country, they're going to have a much more difficult time getting any kind of redress for the people they usually represent.
Are the companies that employ immigrant workers aware of these problems?
Many people are aware. You know, we had a grower in Florida, a major tomato grower, say, in a side piece that we've done, he talks about the dark underside of agriculture. Many of the companies that become aware of this problem immediately adopt sexual harassment policies and tend to agree that something should be done. But there's still lots of holdouts, lots of people who, as one of our interview subjects says, are in denial.
Now, what happened in a case that you mentioned a little while ago, the one that involved Olivia Tamayo and the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, versus Harris Farms?
Yeah, I would say that that case would not have happened if the current Supreme Court decision were in effect. Because in order to prove that the alleged perpetrator, Rene Rodriguez, was a supervisor, that was critical in the definitions of the law in the case. And you could have argued that Rodriguez really didn't have the power to hire and fire, as the Supreme Court is now discussing. So he may never have, that case may never have gone forward.
And he actually left and went into hiding, and nobody could find him, but you found him?
No, that's a case in Iowa. Rodriguez, we found him simply by doing an exit search. We found his home. He retired. He was given a retirement party by the company. He went to South Texas. We found him there, and you can see him on camera. Another alleged perpetrator in the Iowa situation, who was indicted separately for as part of a human trafficking investigation related to the same company, and he was the main supervisor or manager in the plant. He was indicted and arrested, incarcerated, released 10 years ago, and absconded, as the local sheriff says. We found him in South Texas, or an address for him. We found his mother there. She, in turn, said he was in Mexico and wasn't coming back, but she did indicate that even though there's a warrant out for him, the U.S. Marshals had never come by. We found him on Facebook.
Now, you mentioned in the case of the Harris Farms being a large agribusiness, that it was not possible to bring criminal charges, but it was possible to sue the employers. Why wasn't it possible to charge the attackers in criminal court?
Well, first of all, if you talk with law enforcement people, they will tell you that bringing sexual assault or rape charges are extremely difficult to get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt.
Even as in many of these instances, a lot of women are making the same charge?
I repeat what they say. They also say that, you know, the statistics are that, and I've brought up the subject often, that, you know, in two-thirds of rape cases, they're not reported, according to the Department of Justice. So here you have somebody reporting that something went on, like assault or rape. You have maybe multiple people reporting that a particular supervisor has been assaulting people regularly, and still you won't see any charges. Now, you can ask all kinds of different questions about it. The primary, I think, question is how are you going to prove that? That's for most of the law enforcement people. But often when law enforcement gets the political backing and the will to do investigations, to get involved. They do find the evidence. They do the investigation. We haven't seen that in this instance, nor have we seen federal agencies, for example, in the South in the 60s, as Robert Reich, who we interviewed, talked about it. The FBI would get involved if the local authorities did not enforce the law, and therefore they were giving up their, in a sense, responsibility under the law to protect the civil rights of people. So you may recall that the FBI went in, people went on trial for denying the civil rights of people who were murdered. That hasn't happened in the Hispanic context at all nationally or in the context of agriculture.
My guess is Lowell Bergman, his his show for PBS, Rape in the Fields, The Hidden Reality of Rape and the Job in America, will be on Frontline tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS stations. And then is this a real departure on Saturday, June 29th at 7 p.m. on Univision?
Yeah, this will be the first time that PBS has partnered with another broadcasting network in any kind of documentary or news venue that we can find or that WGBH in Boston could find. It's also the first time that there's been a documentary on the same subject in English and Spanish being broadcast over free television nationally, I think, ever.
And this is also done in collaboration with the Center for Investigative Reporting, the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley, which is where you are located. Would it be possible for just a television crew from PBS, a Frontline crew, to have done this all by itself?
Frontline actually is produced by independent producers primarily, many of us regular contributors, but nevertheless more like a magazine. So on your own, no, you couldn't do this. It was, in fact, a graduate student of mine who came up with the original lead 4 years ago. It was us sitting on it for the last 4 years collecting string. A year ago, getting all the various collaborators together to do additional reporting because we'd made a couple of breakthroughs in trying to tell the story. And then the last year to do it. And I have to say, a process not only that's worked out really well in terms of some of the pieces. Univision, by the way, has already done 3 pieces on their own network, 2 on Sunday, 1 yesterday, and they're continuing to promote it on TV. And what we hoped by doing this, and Jorge Ramos, their anchor, assured me it would happen, and it seems to be, is where we, as an Anglo, if you will, network, that is in terms of the audience, our primary audience, can finally be heard in the Hispanic community. And I think that's extremely important, particularly in stories like this.
Do you think one of the reasons there hasn't been more action against the perpetrators is that the public in general is ambivalent about undocumented workers?
Oh, I think the public in general doesn't see them. They're invisible. But your public, your listeners care more about whether or not their organic food is really organic than who picks the crops.
Well,
I mean, the consequences for the people out there, you know, it's one of the issues here, is that the consequences of having abundant agricultural produce in the United States at a low cost is that someone pays for that.
But I think that they might be concerned if they knew that the people who are picking the crops are victims of sexual abuse.
Well, some people would say that that's the reason why we do this work. Let's hope that the story gets out and something might take place. But given, for instance, the Supreme Court decision the other day, which influences the ability of the one agency that's active in this area to actually make cases, given the fact that we're diverted into all kinds of other stories or issues, a basic one, many people feel that these people shouldn't be here. They should all go back to Mexico or Guatemala or wherever they came from.
My guest is Lowell Bergman. His piece for Frontline, Rape in the Fields, The Hidden Reality of Rape and the Job in America, is going to be broadcast tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS stations, and then Saturday, June 29th, 7 p.m. on Univision. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Lowell Bergman. talking about the PBS Frontline investigation into crimes against migrant women workers, a new documentary, Rape in the Fields, The Hidden Reality of Rape on the Job in America, a collaboration with Univision News, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley, which airs tonight at 10 on PBS, and then on June 29th, this coming Saturday, at 7 p.m. on Univision. You report on a major case involving Evans Fruit, which only went to trial a few months ago. How many women came forward in that case?
Well, altogether 26. The woman, actually, a young woman, Jacqueline Abundez, who actually started the litigation when she was a teenager, was murdered about 2 years before she filed in 2006, two years after that. So 25, and then the judge eliminated 11 of 10 of the other of the claimants before it went to trial itself and narrowed the case.
How long are the women saying that they were harassed?
Well, it's interesting because the there's a time limit under the EEOC statute. You have to report within 300 days of the first claim, and that's the time limit he made. It's 300 days since you were harassed. So most of the harassment that was detailed in the case, or assaults, and in fact a couple of allegations of attempted rape, took place between about 2004 and the present. We don't know how far back it's gone. We have talked with women who came forward on their own in the course of our investigation who talked about it going back as many as 20 years.
Now, why did it take so long for the case to end up in court?
Well, this is the process that the EEOC, this agency, you may have seen their literature posted on your employer's wall telling you what your rights are. This is the process that they have to go through. First, you make a charge, then they have to investigate it in confidence. It's not public. Then they have to go through a process of trying to settle the claim with the employer in question. And then if that doesn't work out, they'll finally file a lawsuit, which in this case they did in 2010. And it took an additional 4 years for it to finally get to trial.
And I don't know whether I should give away the way the trial came out, but it is an example of the kind of frustration that people involved would feel. You interviewed the man the women accused, the plant's foreman, Juan Marin, and he denied even knowing most of them. It was one of the scariest interviews I've ever seen.
Well, I mean, his position is that this is all lies. And his explanation, as we give it, is that since he was in a position of power, he hired and fired 800 people every year. He was running something called the Rattlesnake Ranch, which is part of the 17,000 or so acres of Evans Fruit Company has in the Yakima area. And he had been doing it for 30 years, 20 years as a supervisor. So he just chalked it all up to people just lying, wanting to make money in a civil suit, wanting to get papers, etc.
You quote Representative Luis Gutierrez of Illinois saying, "There's a real terror," those are his words, "in the immigrant community. Do all immigrant women working in the fields or in processing plants need to be fearful or watchful?"
Well, as he pointed out, 1,400 people every day are being deported. We're talking about the largest mass deportation going on in the history of the United States under the Obama administration, 400,000 people a year. So I would one of the people that we interviewed, after she got papers, which was after she had filed her claim, got deported herself.
Despite the fact that...
And came back because she was able to prove that she actually had a green card, but she claims that the ICE agents who hauled her away tore it up. But she was sent back to Mexico. So people are picked up off the streets, apparently, if they look like they may be undocumented.
Some of the cases sound like they approach conditions of slavery. Can you talk about DeCosta eggs?
Well, we can talk about one of the things I learned is that there is a human trafficking task force of the Justice Department. They have made slavery cases in the United States, mostly agricultural, from Florida to Central California. But they generally, those kinds of cases involve the cartels or human trafficking cartel holding people by gunpoint. In DeCoster, the company actually had a subsidiary or a partnership, if you will, to be more accurate, that imported women to their plants in Iowa, and men, whole families, from villages in Mexico. So they were a vertically integrated operation where those people were totally dependent upon them, in this case in the area around Clarion, Iowa, about an hour and a half north of Des Moines. And the women there, the area became a target for immigration raids. The supervisors, according to the women, used to lock everyone in the plants, whole families, wouldn't let them go home, and because they were fearful that immigration would pick up people walking around in the streets or in their cars because they were literally patrolling the streets. And then every now and then they would actually raid the facilities. That all took place, and there were various deportations going on. What the federal agencies involved, and the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Labor, as well as immigration authorities, were all present in this plant, some with people on site. They say that they didn't either see or ask about what? Sexual violence. In the middle of all of this, seven of the women come forward and go to the local sheriff and tell them their stories. Eventually it's 13, but those seven were raped, they said, serially. Many of them didn't know what to do, and as the immigration lawyer who first interviewed them, Sonia Parra, says, the woman said to her, I want to stop having sex at work. I need the job, but I don't want to have sex at work. And as she says, that's when I realized the magnitude of the problem.
The sheriff seemed to be rather sympathetic, but felt he could do nothing.
The sheriff, I think, understood that that women wouldn't come forward to him or any undocumented person because of fear that they would be deported, since his own deputies would back up immigration raids. On the other hand, when they did come forward, he attempted to do something about it. He took their statements, he invited in the FBI, he contacted other authorities, but in the end, there were no criminal charges. There was a civil settlement with the EEOC between DeCoster and the EEOC for, I believe, $1.3 million.
Now, if the company was importing undocumented workers, isn't that a clear violation of the laws by company management? Did managers face prosecution?
Yeah, there was a separate case brought by the Justice Department against the company, partially owned by DeCoster, that was importing workers. And the supervisors in the DeCoster plant, including the main supervisor, a man named Ricardo Renteria, was indicted for harboring aliens. He was indicted for that, not for the sexual violence charges, of which he was one of the people identified by the women, by most of the women. Renteria jumped bail after he was let out of jail and booked and disappeared, as the sheriff says, absconded. We went to the U.S. Marshals, got his photograph from them, went to Nexus, found a last known address, turned out to be his mother's house. And then when we looked, and his mother says on camera, the marshals have never been here. And then we found him on Facebook.
And he seemed, one of his friends was a member of the DeCoster family.
Two are listed on the Facebook, and one in particular is the guy who, the member of the family who ran the operations in Iowa, and I believe still does.
I'm talking to Lowell Bergman about Rape in the Fields, the hidden reality of rape on the job in America. It'll be a Frontline show tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS, and then Saturday, June 29th at 7 p.m. it will be on Univision. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Many of the places we're talking about are huge. DeCoster turns out, is it possible that I ate a DeCoster egg sometime in the recent past?
I don't know, sir, but if it depends on how many eggs you ingested. And
but they have one of the largest operations in the country, don't they?
They did, and they did until they had became held. They're being currently there's a grand jury investigation because they were behind the largest salmonella poisoning of the public on record 2 years ago, and most of their operations are now being leased out to other operators. So, as I understand it, they still own the factories. But they're from Maine to Iowa. They've had operations in Maryland and Ohio as well. And no question that they've sold billions of eggs.
And then Evans Farms, the apple producer, has millions of apples every year.
Hundreds of millions.
Agribusiness is politically powerful with strong political connections in both parties. Have any major agricultural firms taken a position on protecting workers in the fields?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a major, for instance, the largest lettuce grower in the world is a company called Tamara and Antle. In Northern California, they were the subject of an EEOC case 15 years ago, but they settled. They didn't go to trial, and they publicly instituted all kinds of policies. You should understand that in three states in the United States, New York is not one of them, the state law mandates sexual harassment training for all supervisors in a company with, I think it's usually more than 15 or 50 employees, depending upon which state you're in. In the rest of the United States, it's voluntary.
Now, many people in Congress have close ties to agriculture, and some of them actually are farmers as well. Do any of them that we know of benefit from undocumented immigrant labor?
You know, that wasn't our investigation, but if you're in the office building that you're in New York City, you're probably benefiting from undocumented immigrant labor amongst the janitorial people who were there at night. And let me point out, one of the things we learned is that while it appears to be a serious problem in agriculture, numbers don't really exist in that sector in any detail. The numbers in the service industry, and particularly the industry I'm talking about, are much higher in terms of the number of cases reported, the number of cases that the EEOC, for example, has both pursued but also charges that it gets. Women are being raped in office buildings, apparently regularly, and the public record seems to reflect that. And they have very few, well, you know, Dominic Strauss-Kahn. There's a good example. Immigrant labor, a rape or apparent rape, and then you see the consequences.
Well, international human rights law protects workers in the United States regardless of their immigration status. And the United States ratified the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights in 1992. Have we met our obligations?
Well, we have. The federal government has a human trafficking task force for just that reason, which involves the FBI, recently brought in the EEOC in meetings in Washington, D.C., to include them in that in those meetings. By the way, one of the things we discovered when we started out on this is that federal prosecutors, for instance, here in California, were completely unaware of EEOC cases in their jurisdictions, ones that have become public, much less ones that were under investigation. So there was while there's been an attempt by the U.S. government on various levels to enforce that treaty, it hasn't extended into this area, with the exception of the EEOC. And as I mentioned before, I would say now the slightly damaged EEOC, they never had a lot of authority, but they've got less today.
Robert Reich makes a couple of points in your film. First, that the fines that the companies that are levied against the companies are so low that employers conclude they might as well just pay the fines.
Well, he's talking specifically too about DeCoster, because when he was Secretary of Labor, he was personally involved in allegations made about DeCoster on not just wage and hour violations, EPA violations. A complaint from the Mexican government that their workers were being kept in conditions of servitude. So he was very familiar with DeCoster, and that's one of the reasons we went to him.
But he also says that companies that violate some laws often violate many.
Mm-hmm.
Did he recommend any solutions?
Well, in the DeCoster case, you know, he has become even more aware of it because of, in part, he became aware of some of the allegations in Iowa after he left the department. His curiosity is why the FBI or the Justice Department hasn't intervened in an attempt to protect the civil rights of these workers, since local authorities don't seem to be up to prosecuting them. That's an answer to that question. We attempted to get out of Washington. Primarily, the answer we got was it's not our jurisdiction.
There's a big push to make regulation more efficient. Is that having an impact on the rights of workers?
You mean by efficient, you mean less forceful?
Well, the words that are being used are more efficient. Cast unseen, for example.
Sight unseen, whatever the specific example is, it's hard to say. We can make the general observation that there's a lot of, for instance, in Iowa, there's a lot of political resistance to this kind of enforcement, politically, particularly from Senator Grassley. We attempted to interview not only people in the industry as industry representatives, and we got a few of those, one of whom you'll see in the film, but we struck out completely trying to find people who would, in a sense, represent the position you're talking about, whether it was at the Heritage Foundation, Senator Cruz, Senator Grassley, and a list, long list of others.
Lowell Bergman, the documentary Rape in the Fields, the hidden reality of rape on the job in America. It's presented by Frontline tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS. And then this Saturday, June 29th, at 7 p.m., a Spanish language version, although there's a lot of Spanish spoken in the Frontline version, will be on Univision. And my great thanks to you for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.